Good afternoon, and welcome to the Thursday, November 19th meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. And I think all of our members will be here shortly, but we do want to get started because we have a really exciting agenda and also a time certain on it at 2:30. We're going to be doing, I think, the second ever video teleconference hookup with a panel of small business folks who are going to be testifying from Deschutes County. And so we have to get through everything else before that. But we've got a lot of really important presentations lined up. So we're going to start right in. And our first informational presentation is our friends from the Employment Department, Lori Warner and Tom Byerly. I feel like we have you now. We just sort of have a template. You're on every agenda, but that is because there's always something new and things happening in the world of unemployment and services to the unemployed. So we talked a little bit about what you were going to talk about. I think primarily you're going to give us an update on what has gone on since the last time we met with the federal legislation that passed on our unemployment insurance extension.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Director of the Employment Department, and with me is Tom Byerly, the Division Administrator for Unemployment Insurance. So this is a quick update for you folks. We talked at length about some of this last time you met, and you got an update letter from me, legislators did, on November 5th. The two items that we're going to elaborate on here today were talked about in the letter that I had sent. The Emergency Unemployment Compensation extension that was approved by Congress. Tom's going to go through the details on what that means for Oregon. I will tell you it is complicated because now there are four tiers of emergency unemployment compensation at the federal level. And so as Oregonians move in and out of these benefit programs, they are struggling with understanding where they are and how many weeks they have and when those weeks might end and et cetera. So you may have constituents that have those concerns. We have noticed an uptick in the number of questions we're getting and the inquiry line in the call centers that Tom's going to give you some numbers on. So we don't know how to make it less complicated because it is a federal extension and there's rules about how this gets applied. Secondly, we're going to talk about the program that you approved in the last session that started November 1st, which is the Economically Distressed Workers Program, which is a really important piece of legislation that allows the lower wage workers to draw their unemployment insurance while they're in training. So Tom's going to talk to you about some details in the administrative rules for that particular program. I just want to mention that, you know, the context still for Oregon, we issued the unemployment rate on Monday this week, so I assume you folks noticed that. It was at 11.3% in October. The September figure was also revised to 11.3%, so we're holding there. It's the lowest rate since the rate was 10.7% in February last year, and it's down from the peak, that high of 12.2 that occurred in May. We still lost jobs last month, about 2,000 jobs, so it's not that we're not finished losing jobs, it's that it is slowing down some. September job loss was about 6,000. So for the department, we still have very high workload and have lots going on within the department and expect to see unemployment climb up at some point through December and January to a peak then of some level within the 11-12% range. So with that, I'm going to let Tom talk to you about details of the slides.
Yes, Senator Monroe. And I'm going to ask people to hold questions till the end, but if you have one right now.
This very point. We're still losing jobs, and yet our unemployment rate is not going up.
Remember that, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, remember that the unemployment rate is a survey of a percentage survey of Oregonians, and it is also based on the number of folks reporting that they're not working or have gone, are working part-time, those kinds of issues, as well as people are still moving into Oregon. We still have people moving here, even though they may not have a job, or they move here and they've lost a job shortly after they move here. So the way the unemployment rate is calculated, we are still losing jobs. 2,000 jobs is not that many in the scheme of things, so remember that too.
So would this be that more and more people are just giving up and not looking anymore?
Some that is the case. I think Art Ayer spoke with you about that last time when he was here, the fact that people, some folks have stopped looking for work because they feel better about their portfolio if they're retired, that is looking a little bit better, and then other folks have decided to go back to school because they were discouraged about looking for jobs, those kinds of things. All of that kind of all of those factors influence what this rate turns out to be monthly.
Okay, thank you. And if we could hold questions till we're done with this segment, and then ask a limited number because we do have to move at a pretty fast clip to get to our 2:30 time certain. Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name
He's talking really fast.
I don't know. Just wait until I get to the technical stuff.
Yeah, there aren't that many slides, though.
Tom Byerly, Administrator of the UI Division for the Employment Department. Thank you for your time today. I wanted to go a little bit over what has been going on with the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program. It's the federal program. Before this bill passed, we had two tiers of EUC. One was, the first tier was 20 weeks, and the second tier was 13 weeks, and we qualified for the second tier in Oregon because our unemployment rate was over 8.5%. Congress wanted to extend EUC to more states that didn't have an 8.5% unemployment rate, so they tinkered with tier 2 and expanded it from 13 to 14 weeks. So They added that 1 week to Tier 2. They then added a Tier 3 for states that are over 8.5%, and over 6%, excuse me. And then they added a Tier 4 of 6 weeks for states that are over 8.5%, like Oregon. The bill became effective with the week of November 8th through the 14th. And we've been paying Tier 2 since last November, and so there was some of our customers that had already exhausted that 13 weeks of Tier 2. This week, we went back and grabbed those folks and gave them that 14th week of Tier 2. We're one of the few states that could turn on a dime and get that back up and going, and we did that this week. And now, next week, we'll start paying Tier 3 to those people that had exhausted, and we're on another extension like the Oregon Emergency Extension that was passed this session, and I'll get into that a little bit later. With the Tier 4, that's for states that have an extremely high unemployment rate. Now, there's a caveat with Tier 4, and herein lies the problem that we're facing. The EUC law sunsets December 31 of this year. In order for us to get to Tier 4 for our unemployed Oregonians, we need that program extended by Congress. So there's conversations going on right now. I've spoken personally with DeFazio's office and Wyden's office, and Lori and I were on a conference call with some House Ways and Means staffers. It sounds like they're going to do something, but as I told DeFazio's staff today, my gosh, it's Thanksgiving. I'm getting nervous. So things are moving in that regard. So what have we been doing since this bill passed? We've notified all the eligible claimants. We've moved them off other extensions that they were on over to the 14th week of Tier 2 or Tier 3. We have not required our customers to do anything to make that switch. We have done it either automatically, or staff have gone individually into claims and made sure the switch had occurred. While claimants didn't have to contact us, you can imagine there's lots and lots and lots of questions. They hear things in the press. They get our letters that say you get an extra week here and 13 more weeks here and 6 more weeks there. And all they really want to know is, how much longer am I going to get unemployment insurance benefits? Because they're desperate and they're not seeing jobs coming, and so they're just anxious. So our inquiry lines, needless to say, have been absolutely swamped. I was telling Lori yesterday in our briefing that at one point during the day, we had no calls waiting to file a new claim, but almost 200 calls waiting just to ask questions. So We're doing our best with written communications, website updates, press releases, but there's still a lot of questions. As Lori intimated earlier, it's a complicated program.
Well, I think we get a lot of calls in the director's office, too, but each one has to be handled individually because there isn't just one answer. So the website has information for them, but it doesn't necessarily answer their particular question. So it's really a one-on-one conversation to sort it out.
Right.
It takes time.
This is a quick slide. I've already sort of covered it, is how this has impacted other extensions. We had claimants on the federal EB extended benefits. We had people on the state extension. We've moved them off of that back onto the federal extension. Our goal is to pay as much in federal money first before we reach state money. And so those, again, were automatically switched over. And throughout this payment of extensions, I wanted to just slip in that every time we have a new quarter, every time a quarter change occurs, we have to look at people's claims to ensure there's no eligibility for a new claim, and sometimes that occurs. And you may be hearing about that from your constituents as well. They may have been on a higher extended claim and have to go to a lower regular claim. And we're dealing with those on a case-by-case basis as they arise. I wanted to share really quickly the impact to the Oregon Emergency Benefit Program that was passed by the 2009 legislature. The bill was, or the new law was to run from October 4th through January 2nd, 13 weeks. And there was a cap of $30 million put on it, basically to keep the impact of the trust fund as low as possible. With EUC's expansion, we have moved people off the Oregon Emergency Benefit Extension. I wanted you to know that we paid out $9.7 million, you see there, an average of $1.9 million. A little over 9,000 claimants have been paid at about 7,300 payments per week. So by moving people back to EUC, we're actually saving money to the trust fund. Lori mentioned a little update on the economically distressed worker training program. This was passed through HB 3483. This is a program that allows individuals that were earning less than 110% of the minimum wage during the period against which their claim was filed, and they're able to attend training just like we've done for many, many years with dislocated workers. If they want to go back to school, be it through private educators or community colleges or other higher education institutions, they can do that and still draw their unemployment insurance benefits. Don't have a lot of data to report. It was effective November 1. We estimate about 2,400 claims per year will avail themselves of this program. So what have we been doing? We've been marketing the program. We've sent notice to eligible claimants. We're mailing letters last week and this week to those that might be potentially eligible. Be about 10,000 letters going out. We mail a letter every day to all new claimants about training opportunities and opportunities through Pell Grants to go to school. We've updated that Pell Grant letter that, again, goes out every day following the filing of a new claim to mention and describe this program. We have updated our website to show that the program is available. We have been corresponding regularly with community colleges, workforce development, and our WIA partners about the program. And we've also developed, in concert with our partners at community colleges and Workforce Investment Act, some temporary administrative rules to specify the eligibility criteria. So, yes, Madam Chair, I know I spoke really, really fast, but I'd be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Yeah, we definitely do have time for questions, and that was a great but speedy but very thorough overview. So, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, the economically distressed program, which allows people to retrain themselves, community colleges and other places, and still retain their benefits, is something I'm very, very interested in. You know, I'm a member of the Mount Hood Community College Board, and I would like to, as soon as you have some statistics, some numbers on how that program is working, how many people are availing themselves of it, and the impact overall, I'd be interested in that. It strikes me that to cut off somebody's benefits if they try to retrain themselves, it would really be a destructive thing, and that's why I was such a strong supporter of this when we passed it last session.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, we're happy to do that. If email would work, I'm happy to send you the
email would be great.
Information as we get it. And that reminded me, one of the things I wanted to mention is November 1 is basically almost the tail end of the fall term. So you can imagine we're not getting a lot of people jumping into school right now. But we've been having a lot of information sharing sessions and a lot of phone calls. And as winter term starts, you're going to see a significant increase. And that's when we'll be having some numbers to share. So at your February update, we'll probably have a lot more to bring and to share about how things are going and the interest and the kinds of training people are going into.
Yeah, I mean, this would be a great topic for some further hearings in February when we have time, because there's also, I think, going to potentially be a capacity question since the community colleges are already bursting at the seams.
Yeah.
If there really is a big, enthusiastic response to this program, then we have to think about where are these people going to go.
Madam Chair, we do have a lot of interest for the dislocated workers going to school, and that has been, there have been some pockets of, really full colleges, so we'll be watching that with our partners.
Are there questions for the employment department? Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Had an interesting thing happen this year. A lot of our business is seasonal, so we bring in a large amount of seasonal people. We'd offered jobs to people, and they would say, how long does the job last? And we said about 30 to 45 days. And they declined it, saying, no, they extended my unemployment benefits, and it'll interfere with my unemployment benefits. Do you have any idea why they would say that? I mean, what's the counter incentive there? Because I kind of thought that was kind of odd. We actually didn't fill, I think, four positions because it's getting too difficult to fill them in a timely manner.
Madam Chair, Senator George, first of all, when that happens, I'd be interested to know about it because the people are required to accept work. Secondarily, it can actually help your unemployment insurance claim if you're making less than your benefit amount.
That's
and working
what I thought
less
too.
Than full-time, working less than 40 hours, you can actually augment your unemployment insurance. You wouldn't get a full unemployment insurance benefit payment, but you could get a partial payment and an unemployment insurance check. Downstream, there may be a concern that if they work enough, they would qualify for a claim that would be a lesser amount, and that more and more that's occurring because of this extended recession. People have been on unemployment for longer than a year, and so they may be thinking about that, but to be really honest and blunt, it's not good cause to turn down work.
I was kind of surprised at how often we bumped into that. It was like, well, I got X number of weeks left, and I'll look for a better job, I guess, is what they say.
Well, okay. We'd love to hear about that when that happens, though.
But, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I do think based on the kinds of inquiries I get and the letters I get in the director's office that people don't always understand. They know that they have to report wages if they're working, and they don't necessarily know what that will mean to their claim. So I don't know how... you judge whether or not they understood what that impact was, or maybe they were just fearful there would be an impact and they didn't want to lose benefits. So, because it is clear that they have to report earnings, and so that impact is sometimes can be a source, I think, of anxiety around, if I take this short-term job, what will that mean to my benefits?
That's how I interpreted what happened. Like,
but
I thought
they
it was going to have a negative impact on their long-term benefits.
It's not good reason to refuse work, yeah.
Yeah, again, I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll send you an email so you have a place to send those kinds of comments when that happens.
Yeah. It was just very interesting. It was a phenomenon I'd never bumped into before.
Yeah.
That's the first time.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since we're on that topic, I appreciate that. Also, I had a call from a constituent business owner recently and said they had 11 vacant positions, and in a year they filled two because everybody that they spoke with didn't want the $10 to $12 an hour, because between unemployment, food stamps, all the other entitlements that they're getting, and these potential employees said they were also doing some on the side cash jobs that they didn't have to report, but they were perfectly happy, and this allowed them to go skiing or whatever, in all this extra time. But there are a lot of people out there who are perfectly content on unemployment and all the other entitlements that they qualify for. So I don't know how widespread that is, but
I would appreciate, Madam Chair, Senator Telford, I'd appreciate hearing about that when that occurs. If your constituents have names, I would be interested in seeing those.
And so do you know, were those jobs listed on the employment department's?
I would imagine that's usually how they get their
applicants. Madam Chairman, were they permanent jobs or seasonal?
No, these were permanent jobs.
These are permanent.
And they started, I think they started like $10 an hour, and then, you know, within a few weeks they get up. I mean,
right.
It's
right. So they were permanent long-term jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah, we'd
like
about
to know.
That.
Right.
So I had one question about something I just read about, and it's not part of your presentation, but apparently we just got some grant monies from the federal government. I just read this
exciting.
In the Oregonian today, a $1.25 million grant
right.
that you're administering for some green jobs
Madam
training?
Chair,
or?
Members of the committee, we did apply. It's ARRA money, and they had various categories of funding for different projects, and one of the grants that we applied for with a number of partners, I want to say, because community colleges and workforce development and our workforce partners, local workforce partners, we collaborated and put in a grant application, and it is around green jobs and data around green jobs and definitional, and so we were successful in receiving that grant. $1.2 million. I will be back to the legislature in February for limitation, but we were successful. The grant money should come in sometime in December, so that's a
great.
Real positive thing. Yeah, we were successful competing.
Yeah, I mean, I just think although we're not excited to have these high unemployment numbers, there are so many things that Oregon mm-hmm. is doing right compared to other states who are in serious deficit problems with their
right.
trust funds. And I know that, I'm sure you do too, but I get calls, you know, saying, can you come talk about how does it work in Oregon, because you guys are solvent when we're totally running out of money, or we're taking loans or asking for loans
right.
from the federal government. So,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
And on that comment, it troubles me mightily that those states that have not done the job the way we have and kept their unemployment solvent borrow money from the federal government for zero interest, which in essence then is subsidized by states like Oregon that have done it right. That troubles me.
Well, you said a mouthful, Senator.
True.
I see nuts. Okay, well, thank you very much for being
thank
here again
you for the
today.
Opportunity.
And we'll continue this in February. Okay, so our next portion of the agenda is an overview of the process for faculty elections in the Oregon University system. And we have an invited witness, which is two witnesses. Sure. So please come forward and tell us who you are. And members, this actually is a small piece of a much bigger bill that we did have under consideration in our committee, so it might sound familiar to you. So,
Madam Chair, thank you for that introduction. I'll be very limited in my testimony. Rob Wagner, the Director of Political and Legislative Affairs for the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. Our members include university faculty and adjuncts and graduate employees at 5 of the 7 OUS campuses. I'm just going to comment very briefly about the statement the Chair just made about this issue and then turn it over to our Executive Director, Richard Schwartz, to talk a little bit more about what this is, because we'll be looking for a cleanup in the statutes in February, and I believe the Chair is working with Legislative Council right now and getting that drafted. So as a little bit of background on this issue, faculty at Oregon's universities are the only group of employees to have this confusing double ballot procedure that is in the Oregon statutes. And what we are asking for is similar treatment for these employees, similar to faculty at community colleges, teachers, firefighters, nurses, anybody else you can imagine in the public sector. As our executive director, again, is going to talk a little bit about this, but in terms of last session, what I distributed was the bill that we had introduced on the House side, 2703, and it's the similar to what we're going to be looking for in February. And the process on this was that the chair of the House Business and Labor Committee, Chair Schauffler, wanted one bill that had to do with anything in ORS 243, or the collective bargaining statutes, the public employee collective bargaining statutes. So everything that had to do with 243, its definition of supervisory employees, expedited bargaining. If you remember some of those debates, there was one bill that came through, and we hitched our wagon to that concept. During the conversation on the House side and again on the Senate side, no one testified in opposition to our concept, which is unrelated to those other concepts, but we were in the broader bill. And so the wagon train, to continue on the metaphor, was ambushed, and the wheels came off, and we were left without an additional wagon, an additional vehicle. So what we're looking for is, again, to move forward with our wagon alone in February on this issue that would restore similar fair treatment to faculty in terms of union organizing. And with that, I'll turn over to Richard to talk a little bit more about the issue.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. As Rob said, we represent a substantial number of public...
Could you just tell us who you are for the record?
Good point. Richard Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-Z. I'm Executive Director of AFT Oregon, the State Federation for Affiliates of the American Federation of Teachers in Oregon. And among those substantial numbers of public employees we represent are those in the higher education system, including faculty and teaching staff. In essence, this is about the election, the ballot that's used in the election procedure. The Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act has been around for more than 35 years now and has been used for representation for the rights granted public employees in that time through an election process that is similar to any election. Choices are on a ballot, employees mark their choice, and the majority determines the outcome. The core rights that they're exercising are in Section 243.662, which is the right to form, join, and participate in union activities, activities of labor organizations. And the way that that choice is made is first through authorization cards, and then where there is contested issues before the Employment Relations Board processes those representation petitions. Contested issues are, for example, the whether or not certain positions are supervisory or not, or certain positions don't fit the general definition of the bargaining unit that is forms the voting group in representation. Those, in the technical term, used, give rise to a question of representation, and the questions of representation are settled through an election, the election process that's provided in the statute. Typically, the election that's laid out in the board's rules are for a ballot and is determined by a majority vote designation. If there are more than two choices on the ballot, then if there is no majority of votes cast for any one organization, then there's a runoff election by the top two vote getters. No representation is always one of the choices. So if a union is seeking to represent, or employees are seeking to have a union represent them, then it's that choice of that union or no representation. If there are interveners or other unions petitioning for the same group of people, then there's more than one choice of representative on the ballot along with no representative. The anomaly here is for faculty working in institutions under the Oregon State Board of Higher Education. Faculty are the only group that is required to use, and there's a separate procedure for the construction of the ballot and determination of the outcome, and they're required to use a two-part ballot or double ballot. The first question on the ballot is whether or not they choose to be represented by a labor organization for purposes of collective bargaining, and the choice is yes or no. And on my written testimony that I've submitted there, I've given three examples of representation election notices along with the sample ballot. The first one is for a unit of classified employees at a community college. That's attachment A. Attachment B is for a unit of faculty at a community college. And the third is the type of ballot that we're talking about here today, and that's the double ballot or two-part ballot that's used for faculty in institutions under the Oregon State Board of Higher Education, the university system, essentially. So In that they have to, unlike the all other employees and all public employees in all other settings, and unlike employees, including universities and colleges in the private sector under the National Labor Relations Act, this unique provision segregates out the method in which balloting occurs for those for faculty in the higher ed system. So the two-part ballot asks first the question whether or not they wish to be represented, and then it gives the instruction, regardless of how they checked that, whether even if they checked no, they don't want to be represented, they get a second question, and that is a listing of one or more labor organizations that they may be seeking to have represent them. So that can produce a lot of confusion among faculty in voting, because most people, they think if we mark yes, I want to be represented for collective bargaining, that takes care of it. But they need to mark the second part, and in some cases they don't mark the second part. Or they could not mark the first part and go ahead and pick the organization, because that's, after all, who they're seeking to have represent them in the second part. But a failure to mark the first part, that yes or no, they want representation, would void their ballot, even if they picked an organization in the second part. So you can get a lot of permutations, and we've seen most of them, and some in the could even occur in the extreme, where they would mark, yes, they want representation, but then fail to mark any organization on the second part. So the solution to this is just to provide the faculty and the higher ed system with the same type of ballot that's used by and has been used by tens of thousands of other public employees under the state's public employee collective bargaining act. We've had experience with all three of these ballots. I've had experience with the elections in over 30 years in public sector in numerous states, and in the private sector and process cases in over a dozen National Labor Relations Board regional offices, and under the Federal Labor Relations Authority for federal employees. So that's the nature of the issue, and our desire is to see that same right extended in the form of the ballot to faculty of the higher education system. And with that, I'm happy to entertain any questions you have.
Thank you for that explanation. Any questions for these witnesses? No, it doesn't look like there are. And
I'm trying to figure out how our university faculty can't figure out the ballot.
That's
that makes
question.
Me more nervous than anything you guys have said. I'm like, really, they can't figure this out? Okay.
On the other hand, I suppose you could argue that why would that group of people be singled out for a more complicated election procedure than every other person that is covered by the same law?
Well, they're college professors.
It's
I hope they could actually read the ballot, but nonetheless,
I think
no implications on your members.
There's a pipeline there somewhere, but
usually PhDs at that level.
No.
So
I would hope that they would read that.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe that's another reason why unionization is a good idea. So, I don't know.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. Members, the chair and committee staff have requested a redraft of exactly the I think with the dates maybe changed, this bill. So this will come back before us, at our January meeting.
Yes, Madam Chair, I did ask for it prior to our January meeting.
For introduction as a potential committee bill. And you probably don't remember much discussion of this, because when it came over here, it was included in a much bigger bill, and it was no one testified in opposition to it, and so it just didn't get much discussion. And we did contact the Oregon University system and ask them if they wanted to testify, and they had no wish to come in. And so I suppose they will have a chance if they develop a different opinion, but right now it seems to be non-controversial. Okay.
Right, thank you very much.
And it looks like we're right on time to move to the next portion of our agenda. We have three topics, but they're all dealing with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we are honored to have our Labor Commissioner and former State Senator Brad Avakian and his capable... don't know what your title is, because I know you do so many different things, but Kate Newhall.
Well,
so.
Friday.
So welcome to the Commerce Committee, and I believe that Amy Clare is not going to be with us today, so we'll just roll right from one of these topics to the next in whatever order you want to go, and probably pause for questions when we get through with the civil rights before we get into the prevailing wage part.
That would be fine. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Brad Avakian, State Labor Commissioner, and with me is Kate Newhall, the Legislative and Policy Director for the Bureau of Labor. Amy Clare, our Administrator of the Civil Rights Division, was going to be here. She sends her regrets. She went home ill today, and so we will pinch hit as best we can on any questions you have related to civil rights. As I understand it, what you would like to hear, and I think it's a great idea, is for me to give a brief overview of the agency and the things that we do, and then give you an update on the Oregon Council on Civil Rights. Kate Newhall will add a few things related to the Civil Rights Division after that, and then I'll talk about what work the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee has been doing on some potential reforms to the prevailing wage process in the state.
Sounds great.
The Bureau of Labor and Industry is primarily four different things. We have a very large hand in the state's workforce development system with our apprenticeship and training division. We don't actually run apprenticeship facilities, but we certify them and we monitor them to make sure that they are meeting certain standards of quality for graduating skilled workers and for making sure that women and minorities have a way into the trades. We have the state's wage and hour division, part of the enforcement branch of the agency. We enforce all of the state's wage and hour laws, including meal and rest periods, and the prevailing wage unit is a part of the wage and hour division, so we deem what projects will prevail or not prevail, and we also set the prevailing wages for the state of Oregon. Our wage and hour division gets about 25,000 calls a year from individuals with questions about their rights on the job with respect to meal and rest periods and wage and hour type issues. They investigate, and we process through our hearings unit approximately 2,600 cases a year involving wage and hour violations. We also have the state's technical assistance unit, which is our face to Oregon employers. It's a terrific unit that has a hotline that employers can call if they need help navigating their way through the very complicated state and federal employment laws. This unit did in the last year about 220 seminars in all four corners of the state on employment law, and they will even go out to a specific employer who wants their managers taught on a specific topic. So, for instance, if a business wanted their managers to learn more about family leave law, then we could send a team out there to actually help teach their staff or their managers that area. I want to thank the legislature, too, for what you did with respect to this unit last time. A decade or so ago, the general funding was cut completely from this unit, and it has survived only by charging employers for these seminars and for the wage and hour and civil rights and handbooks and so on that you may have seen. But last session, you restored some general funding to the unit, which has stabilized the unit, and we hope in time it becomes generally funded completely again so that we could decrease or eliminate the fees to Oregon's employers. One of the reasons that is so important to us is it's difficult for small business and medium businesses to afford the $160 or $180 to go to a seminar to learn about the laws or to pay the $40 or more for one of the handbooks. Not coincidentally, most of the women and minority-owned businesses in this state are small and medium-sized businesses. So we think those costs have a disparate effect on women and minority-owned businesses. So it was a great first step last session. We're very thankful to the legislature for that. And the fourth division in the agency is the Civil Rights Division. The Bureau of Labor is the state's chief law enforcement agency regarding civil rights protections in this state, and not just in the area of employment. We also do all of the state and federal housing discrimination claims, and we do all investigations related to discrimination in public places. So restaurants and bowling alleys and public parks and so on are all claims that go through the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Unique to our agency also is we don't just enforce those laws against private entities. We have jurisdiction over all of the other state agencies and over local governments with regard to civil rights matters as well. The Civil Rights Division got 32,000 phone calls from Oregonians last year with questions about their civil rights and investigated over 2,200 complaints of discrimination. Now, before I talk about the Council on Civil Rights, I know there was a question, too, about the process that we use. And, Madam Chair, if you'd like, it might be interesting to the committee to know how a complaint is actually processed through the agency.
Sure.
And it also illustrates some of the unique powers of the agency, too. The way it works is when a complaint comes in to the Civil Rights Division, it gets assigned to an investigator. We have a team of very experienced professional investigators. At that point, we are not advocating for the person filing the complaint. You can think of us more as truth seekers. We're investigating in an unbiased way, trying to find what really happened in a situation. Now, if there isn't substantial evidence of discrimination found, the case can be dismissed at that point. If the investigator does find evidence of discrimination, then the case may move to what we call case presenters. They function like prosecutors that prosecute the case to an administrative law judge. And all of these entities, the investigator, the prosecutor, the administrative law judge, are all within the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The judge holds a hearing, which is similar to a trial. Witnesses come, evidence is presented, and then the judge issues a proposed order, which goes to the labor commissioner. And in Oregon, the labor commissioner decides the case, who wins and loses, and also sets the damages in a case. And also unique is the powers of the labor commissioner in this regard. In Oregon, the legislature has vested the labor commissioner with similar powers to a circuit court judge. And so when I get a case like I just described, I have the ability not just to decide who wins and loses, but to assess civil penalties, to assess damages for emotional distress, damages for lost wages and benefits, and even issue cease and desist orders to stop folks who are violating the law from continuing their discriminatory conduct. And the only appeal of those decisions is to the Oregon Court of Appeals and Supreme Court. And the process for a wage and hour complaint is similar in that respect. Now, the Oregon Council on Civil Rights, another of the unique powers of the commissioner in this agency is the ability to create councils and agencies, similar to the governor's power to create boards and commissions. And we used to have in Oregon, a decade or so ago, a Council on Human and Civil Rights. And it went by the wayside, I think, to the great disservice of the state. And so several months ago, I created the Oregon Council on Civil Rights, a 25-member council. People from all faiths and backgrounds and cultures and races and geographically diverse across the state of Oregon. And they will have primarily two tasks. One of them will be to advise me and the Civil Rights Division, as well as the governor and the legislature, if you choose, on matters related to civil rights. That could be pending legislation or ideas for legislation or anything else that happens to be of importance to you. The other is this is a council that will create a vision for the progress of civil rights in Oregon. So it will on its own create an agenda that it thinks is important to the state and then provide that advice to our agency and to you. They've met twice, so they are just organizing and getting ready to go. I did want to let you know what their first assignment is that I've given them. Oregon is 25th in the nation right now in the size of its disparity between the wages that women earn and the wages that men earn. Women earn about 80 cents on the dollar compared to their white male counterparts on the job. Minority men earn about 70 cents on the dollar compared to their white male counterparts. And if you are a minority woman in Oregon, you earn even less money than that compared to your white male counterparts. No state in the country nor the federal government has ever achieved equal pay for equal work. And so the first assignment for this council is to create an action plan that doesn't just close the gap, but that eliminates the disparity between white men and minorities and women in this state. So they will take that on in earnest in the upcoming year and come back with recommendations for us. With that, I think I will stop and let Kate Newhall give you a little more on civil rights.
Great. Go ahead. Thank you. For the record, Kate Newhall, Legislative Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I am, as the Commissioner said, pinch hitting just a little for Amy Clare, who's the Administrator of our Civil Rights Division. I hope I can do it justice as she would. So I believe you're getting passed out to you a handout that includes two pieces on it. First, I'm just going to speak to, on one side, you've got just a grid of the comparison of federal civil rights law with Oregon state civil rights law. For the most part, on the top box, a lot of similarities. The bottom two boxes are areas where Oregon civil rights law includes components that isn't in federal civil rights law. So that's just an overview of the, I think, broad areas of civil rights that the Bureau of Labor and Industry enforces. On the back of that sheet is the organizational chart of the Civil Rights Division. What's interesting and that I want to point out about that, that we have, thanks to the legislature last session, been able to hire some new civil rights investigators, and those folks are in there on gold. We're very excited and happy to have them on staff and helping with some of the civil rights investigations that they're working on. I think the component that I came here to give you all an update on are the recent changes in civil rights legislation since 2007. We've had a number of bills and statute changes that have affected the Bureau's enforcement jurisdiction. And so what we've put together here is just a chart with an overview of each of those laws since 2007. And we've sort of broken them out into some broad issue areas. The first chunk are employment protections and new unlawful employment practices. I think some of the bills on there, just to speak really quickly to Senate Bill 2, which prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation, became effective last January 2008. And what I've also done is include the administrative rule citations on there for you, because as we get to the next couple, you'll see that the agency is right now in the process of rule writing for some of the new 2009 legislation and is in the middle of public comment period on some of those. So I've also tried to flag for you when public comment period closes on the rules that are currently out for comment. Some notable ones are in employment protections, the making it an unlawful employment practice to discriminate against employee on the basis of their uniformed service member protections. I'm just going to keep kind of bumping through here. The next category there are protected leave provisions. There were a number of new uses passed in 2007 allowable for the Oregon Family Leave Act. The first couple that I've flagged there for you allows an employee to use paid sick leave when they're taking family leave, also allows employees to take family leave to care for a grandparent or grandchild. One of the stats that I sort of brought prior to these pieces of legislation, the Bureau was investigating about 270 cases of family leave every year. And now we've seen a slight increase in the number of cases. We're investigating now about 280 cases of family leave each year. On the flip side, one chunk that I'm just going to talk very generally about are what we call substantial equivalency. This was a pretty big thing for the Bureau in 2007. We worked on legislation to make Oregon housing law what we call substantially equivalent to federal fair housing law. And what that allowed the Bureau to do is, now that we have achieved substantial equivalency status, the Bureau is working on a contract with the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, to investigate federal fair housing complaints. And I think that's a benefit to the complainants in this, and in fact, the respondents, because it enables their cases to be investigated closer to home here in Oregon as opposed to in the Seattle office, the regional office of HUD. So the major piece of that legislation was Senate Bill 725 in 2007. We had a couple of other bills, both in 2008 and 2009, to at HUD's request to do some further amendments to state law to keep us substantially equivalent. And beginning in May of 2008, we actually started investigating the federal fair housing cases in the Boley office. And with that, I think I'll close and be happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Okay, any questions for these witnesses on the civil rights portion of our agenda? You may not be prepared with this, and I know Amy's the expert, but do you know offhand a rough breakdown of, you mentioned the number of complaints that you get about family leave concerns. Do you know how the other categories of discrimination complaints might break down? I know at one time that injured worker discrimination was very high on the list of cases you got.
Madam Chair, committee members, the highest percentage of cases that we get are retaliation claims. When somebody files a claim and then whether or not it's a valid claim suffers some type of retaliation either from the management of a business or other coworkers, and then the management doesn't stop the harassment. So we have those types of claims, highest percentage, but injured worker status and gender are the two others that historically make up the top three.
Okay. And I guess my only other question, and it's probably more of a budget matter, is when you did take on the responsibility for those housing complaints that had been done by the federal government, do you get funding from the feds then that fund staff positions that handle those?
We do, Madam Chair, get some reimbursement from the feds. It doesn't always come in as timely a manner as we would like, and it doesn't correlate with the actual cost of doing the investigation. So we're continuing to work with them to build a contract that gives us a good fair compensation. But it is an important thing for us to do because it keeps the investigation local for folks that are being harmed locally and for landlords that deserve an efficient and a quick investigation that they can rely on too. So we're more than happy to do it even though we're not making money on it.
Great. Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, the bill we passed extending civil rights protection based on sexual orientation. I just wondered how that's working out, whether there have been a lot of claims or if the transition in the state is going relatively smoothly, or maybe you could comment a little bit on it because it was quite controversial last session and we got it through finally, and I just wondered how it's working out.
Well, one of the things, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that we did right after I came on about a year and a half ago with the Bureau, was to pull together an interagency task force with all of the various agencies that in some way could be impacted by those new laws. And that group met regularly, crafted a pamphlet of information that could be handed out to folks so that everybody knew what their rights were and knew where they should go within the state for help with various matters. And so and that has trickled down into some of the advocacy groups that work with individuals that could be covered by that law. So the transition, I think, has gone very, very well for the state and for individuals that need the protection, and through our technical assistance division to employers to help teach employers how to accommodate under those new laws. We've had 120. We've had a total of 80 cases that would have come under Senate Bill 2 that are currently being investigated. So a significant number of cases for the Bureau to take on since the law was passed.
Great. Okay, I don't see any other questions on this portion, so just roll on.
Well, let's talk about prevailing wage. I was going to mention one other thing about civil rights that I passed over just in case it's of interest to you. We put together statistics for the House committee that we gave them yesterday that in the last, roughly the last biennium, we returned about $7 million of wages that were due to Oregon workers that had been in one way or another illegally kept from them. So significant amount of money going back to injured or to workers.
And that actually reminds me that we did, I think, get our paws a little bit on the fund of monies that are used when a business does go out of business and people are still owed mm-hmm. wages. Are we now pretty healthy in that fund?
Madam Chair, you're talking about the Wage Security Fund,
right.
And for the benefit of the committee members, this is a fund the state of Oregon has so that when a business goes out of business and cannot make the final paychecks to its employees, we pay them a portion of their wages in order to tide over the family while they are transitioning to new work, and then we go back to that employer if the business continues in order to reimburse the fund. And we were very willing to cooperate with the legislature last time in wanting to give up $2 million out of that fund in order to help other vital services. The legislature took $3 million, and that cut us pretty darn close to still meeting the needs. But it was a good communication between our agency and the legislature in coming to that number, and we have met the needs with what's remaining in that fund, even though it was quite close. And we're now getting to the point where it will start building again, so I think we're going to be just fine.
Great. Okay.
Prevailing wage. Let me, I guess, give you a couple prefatory comments before I tell you why we launched into some of the reforms that we're looking at in the prevailing wage system. It's a quite elaborate system in deciding what the prevailing wage is in various parts of the state of Oregon. That got very interesting when I made my first determinations a year ago. The goal of this is to be able to pay a good living wage on public projects, and in order to do that, the state's policy is to figure out what the predominant wage is for each construction trade in 14 different regions around the state. And the way we do that is we work with the Employment Department, who sends out a survey twice a year to approximately 4,000 contractors. And the survey gets at two pieces of information. The first is whether or not the contractor was using union labor or non-union labor. And then the second part is how much were you paying your workers in all of these various trades. Now, that information comes back to the Employment Department. It then ends up at the Bureau of Labor. It gets collated into notebooks that literally go from this desk to the ceiling. And they land on the commissioner's desk, and I go through every single trade in every single one of the 14 regions and figure out whether or not for that trade, for instance, a carpenter, whether or not carpenters in Region 1 if 50% of their hours or more worked in that region were union or non-union. That's important because under the law, If it's more than 50%, then that trade in that region prevails, meaning every public project will get the prevailing wage for that trade. You then look to the amount that to what the predominant wage was in that region, and then that is used in determining the prevailing wage. Now, if it's under 50%, then what we can do is we can do, in essence, a statewide average of what, for instance, a carpenter generally makes, and then that can be used as the wage that's paid on public projects rather than the higher prevailing wage. What I found was this. The system has a terrific intent behind it to try and find out what each region geographically pays so that you have a wage that reflects that part of the state. The difficulty is not all of the forms come back. And I have the ability of the survey forms, I have the ability to fine a contractor if they don't send it in, but that doesn't mean that I get the information. In addition, there is no method by which to make sure that the information is accurate and reliable. And not implying that people would intentionally lie, but there could be mistakes made. And it's a very important process since it dictates how much money the government and contractors pay on a job and how much these working families are going to earn. I did not believe that the system was reliable enough or accurate enough, and so what I did was I suspended sending out a survey, the mid-year survey, since I didn't believe it would provide me any better information than I had already had. And instead went to the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, which exists to advise the Bureau of Labor on issues like this. I asked them to look at the survey from top to bottom, the entire process, and come back with recommendations to me on what could be done to make the survey easier to fill out for contractors and provide more reliable information for me to make determinations on. They have been working very hard for a number of months. They have come back preliminarily with 9 different recommendations. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I think you've got copies of them up there. Most notably, to delete something called peak week reporting. Contractors don't send in the entire year's worth of data. If they did, it would be too much data for the state to sort through and for the contractors to do. So they pick their busiest week, wherever it happens to be, and that's what they use. The difficulty is, for many contractors, that's the week that they worked in Portland or Eugene or somewhere else in the Willamette Valley and doesn't accurately reflect what's happening in the rural parts of the state. So they came back with a suggestion to use full 12 months instead of just the peak week, to use a web-based reporting system instead of only doing it by paper, to not send the wage survey to temporary labor agencies, to create an audit system to help make it more reliable. And the other one is some changes in the form to make it easier for contractors to fill out and send in. And there's a number of others. They're good suggestions, but these are preliminary. They have till the end of the month to finalize their recommendations. The Employment Department is also coming up with recommendations, and so I expect soon after the end of this month to be creating a new system for getting the information that I can use to set prevailing wages. Some of those might end up with the need for some statutory changes, so I will stay in very close touch with this committee and the House committee.
Great. Okay, well, that was a great explanation, and you covered a lot of territory on both of these topics in a short time, which I really appreciate. So questions about prevailing wage or anything else while we've got the commissioner and Kate here? Okay, it looks like you've answered them all for now, and we certainly will stay tuned if there are things that develop that you think we need to know about. And I know there was more material than we could cover in the time we had today, so I really appreciate you shrinking the presentation.
Thank
and
you.
I hope it is not the start of flu season at your shop.
We've survived it so far.
Thanks a lot. Okay, so now I think we actually have time to take a short break that will enable us to get our technology decks in order.
Yes. See if we might be able to start earlier, Madam Chair. I'm not sure. We can look at that while we recess.
So Senator Telfer has been working very hard on arranging the next portion of the agenda, which, as I said at the outset, is going to be by a video hookup with small business folks who are waiting for us in at
OSU Cascades and Ben.
How about if we take a 5-minute recess and then
we'll come in.
And turn on the equipment.
If we can start early, we can. Ma'am.
Yeah,
if
that'd
not,
be great.
Then we can hold off.
Right. Great. Okay.
The other daughter, so it wasn't that one.
I wanted to make sure that they weren't the two of them weren't together.
Go ahead.
I gaveled us back in. I didn't know if we were just in recess.
Okay, the committee will come back to order, and if you could please connect us up. Hello there in Bend. This is Senator Dianne Rosenbaum, Chair of the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee. Can you see and hear us?
Yes.
Great. Well, we're very excited to have you join us today. I'm going to be turning the gavel over to your state senator, Chris Telfer, the vice chair of our committee, who will introduce our hearing. But because the legislature obviously is suffering budget problems, which I'm sure yours are at least as severe, we haven't been able to get out to other parts of the state as much as we would like to in the interim. So this was a creative way that Senator Telfer and I figured out to reach out. So we hope that this is going to be a good experience for you and enlightening for us as well. So welcome to your state capitol. And I'll turn it over to Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, good to see you all, and I want to thank you all for taking the time out of your busy schedules to show up before the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development, and thank again the committee for reaching out into the communities and talking to some businesses. So we're going to kind of wing it here a little bit. This is our first experience, at least Dianne's and my experience in working with this. So what we thought we might want to do is perhaps take three of you at a time, you know, each being able to speak, and then have questions and answers similar to a panel. Have three of you present, and then we can ask questions versus after each one. We have 9, 10. We have 10, right? Are there 10 there?
We have 9.
We have 9 ourselves.
Okay, we have 9.
Okay.
Well, prior to doing that, let me ask the rest of the Senate committee to introduce themselves, and then just briefly maybe have all of you introduce yourselves so I know which ones exactly they're. Tim's just walking in now, so to my left.
I'm sorry, everyone. Hi, I'm State Senator Floyd Przonski. My district includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties, and I serve here on this committee. I also serve as the chair of Judiciary and serve on the Environment and Natural Resource Committee as a member.
I am Rod Monroe. District 24 is mid Multnomah County, between Portland and Gresham, and the city of Happy Valley in Clackamas County as well. I serve on the full Ways and Means Committee and chaired the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means besides my service on this committee.
And hello again. I'm State Senator Dianne Rosenbaum. My district is in southeast and northeast Portland and Milwaukee, which is in Clackamas County. And in addition to chairing this committee, I serve with Senator Telfer on the Senate Revenue and Finance Committee and also on our Consumer Protection Committee.
So you all know who we are. Actually, why don't I start with Roger Lee, Bill Mosley, and Mike Morford, and have the three of you, in whatever order you've decided to go, kind of give your presentations. I think we've pretty much scheduled it to about 3 minutes per presentation. Is that, Roger, is that what your understanding is?
Yeah, Senator Telfer, we could do that. With the number of people we have, we could probably go 5 minutes. Bill is not here yet, so maybe we could substitute someone else in there.
Okay. So. Peter. How about Peter?
Okay. Great. So, myself, Peter, and who is?
Mike.
Mike. Okay. We're all right here together, so that'd be great.
Okay.
Well, let me maybe just start off by saying that I want to make sure to give a lots of time for our businesses to speak, because I think that's one of the intent of this session is really getting.
Excuse me, Roger. Can I interrupt you 1 second? For the
sure.
record, we need to have you introduce yourself and who you're with, just for the record, and all presenters as you start.
Okay. My name is Roger Lee. I'm the Executive Director of Economic Development for Central Oregon. It serves the Tri-County area here. And I guess in that work that we do with businesses throughout the Tri-County area, primarily traded sector, you know, there are frequent issues that come up that impact or the legislature impacts their ability to, I think, successfully do business in the state. You know, it was an interesting session for us trying to administer programs like the Enterprise Zone program, Enterprise Zone, where, you know, we have established program that was looking at some substantial changes proposed, but eventually wound up dying in committee. But some of the changes around you know, prevailing wage really felt like didn't make sense as far as the businesses are concerned, and really was maybe a disconnect with what they were trying to do with what maybe some objectives were coming out of Salem. So I have to say, from our experience, and my comments will be much more general than probably others, is that we hear a lot from businesses just saying, you know, create a consistent and equitable and a fair environment in which we can do business, and one that perhaps is not so, it's rapidly changing enough in their own sectors without having maybe the rules change continually, whether it's workforce, employment law, or some of these other things that are seems to be always on the move. So that's some of the general comments we hear. And obviously the other big one we hear right now is just general finance is very difficult to obtain, whether you're an existing established business or whether you're trying to start a new venture. That piece is one that's probably less up to the legislature to really solve, but it is something that is impacted by other programs. For example, the Workforce Response Team, which is definitely a workforce, state workforce-directed program, we call it the WRT here. It goes through TACOA and some of the other organizations that are overseeing workforce in the state. It's a program that has continued to build momentum, and yet it's being pared back bit by bit year after year. So we'd like to see some of those return, because we believe it's helping deliver the training, and I think the businesses will talk about this. It's helping them be competitive in the national and global marketplace, where and resources that they don't have in their own organizations, they can be matched with what's being provided through those programs. So those are the few general comments I have, and I want to make sure to give plenty of time for the president, CEOs, other business owners around the table. So with that, I'll pass the baton to Mike.
Okay. My name is Mike Morford. I'm the CEO of a company called Alltrek.com. We're an outdoor online e-commerce company. And I'll just provide a little bit of background. We moved from the Seattle market 3 years ago to Central Oregon. And in the process, we assessed 7 different cities. 6 other cities were all outside of the state of Oregon, spread all over the West Coast. And we, after a number of analyses and research, we made the decision to move to Redmond, partially because of the economic enterprise zone. But we looked at a number of factors, and I'll explain those very briefly. Since we have moved here, we have increased our workforce by 4-fold, and we have increased our payroll by more than 4-fold. And we are, as far as employment goes, we're providing an above-average wage across the board. And we are a traded sector business. More than 99% of our business is outside of the state of Oregon. And in fact, we service 23 different countries around the world. And we find ourselves very much in a globally competitive marketplace where we are competing with companies outside of the state, companies outside of the country, and companies that are in developing worlds such as India, Czechoslovakia, and what have you. Our growth has been fairly decent over the last several years. As I mentioned, we've increased our staff by more than 4-fold and our payroll. We don't necessarily disclose total revenue growth, but that has grown in a consistent manner. When we made the decision to come to Central Oregon, we looked at the cost of living, we looked at the average wage, the cost that it would require to build the warehouse facilities, the call centers, and the office that we built. And we looked at the educational environment as well and compared that with a number of other cities. We found the cities that we compared against were somewhat lifestyle-oriented, like Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, Boulder, Colorado, Reno, Nevada, and Boise, Idaho, and I think there was another in there. But what we looked at was we felt that in comparing against those cities, Redmond, because of the economic enterprise zone, it just barely tipped the scales to move there. We later found that Ogden, Utah actually had a similar program targeting companies like ours, and have since researched that and seen that in Ogden there is a lot of attractive incentives that have been rolled out, and they've pulled in multi-billion dollar companies like Amercorp to move into their city and have produced quite a bit of growth. So I would just point that out as possibly a place to research ideas. The key issues that we look at, we've taken advantage of the economic enterprise zone incentives, the workforce training, which education and intellectual capital is really what our business is all about, and benefited from that. We are also currently in the process of working with the Oregon Business Development Fund and looking at a loan package from them, and we have had a mixed experience in some ways working with economic development with Roger Lee and the local economic development folks in Redmond. We've had a great experience working with Oregon Business Development. It has been a good experience, but it has taken a long time for the state to be able to make a move towards our business and actually helping us out, and that has been a source of frustration. So that's the short version of Altrek.
Thank you, Mike. Peter.
Hello, my name is Peter Newport, and I serve as the president of Breed Love Guitar Company. And I brought props so you can see what the heck we do. So I think one prop will likely do it. Can you see this?
Oh, yes, definitely.
All right, this is a beautiful Breed Love guitar. And what's interesting about this guitar is all the parts of it are from Oregon. And so this is Oregon Myrtlewood, which we position around the world as Oregon's exotic wood. And you've probably seen all sorts of knickknacks on the coast over time, but it's a wonderful tone wood. The binding's Oregon walnut. The top is Sitka spruce, and that grows from Oregon all the way up into Alaska and Canada. And then some artwork of Native American totem images, and even the neck was grown in Oregon. So it's an example. You know, we're a small company. We've been around the $10 million in revenue for the last couple of years. And 10 years ago, we were about $500,000 in revenue. And with the help of our friends at EDCO, we have been able to build a new building over the last 2 years. So we spent about $5 million in infrastructure in Bend over the last 2 years, and thanks to Roger and Eric. But that's just a drop in the bucket. We're a leader in our industry, and we're still in our infancy of growth. And so we were just written up in Music Trades magazine as one of the leaders in guitar building and in dealer profits around the world. And then we were just written up in Guitar Aficionado. This is a really nice magazine. And there's a vacation that we offer, a guitar building vacation, which we call it's the guitarist vacation complete with the ultimate souvenir. And so also being born in Bend, you know, it's a very different case of researching a place to live. I was born here and really wanted to create a life here, and a series of lost bets. I ended up the president of Breed Love Guitar Company, and it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. But I think our challenges are really from here forward. And we have a vision, and we have a vision of, we're really at the infancy of being a $100 million company, and we're growing into a $100 million revenue company over the next 10 years, and becoming a global leader in music products, guitars, and so on. And this is where we really need the help. And if luck is defined as where preparation meets opportunity, we're prepared to make the steps to grow into that company. And we'll become probably one of the anchors of what people think of as Central Oregon, both in providing performance, providing education in the schools, and creating a pull of like companies to the area. And so we'll likely be investing over $100 million in infrastructure in the next 10 years and developing $100 million in revenue per year. So if you look at that as a 7x multiplier, as we get into that, that's a $700 million impact on Central Oregon. And, you know, with a 400 to 500 employee base in a craft music type of an industry. So I'm glad to be involved because I want to know what's possible. And I know the programs don't fund that 100%, but I view EDCO and the state as if we can at least get some votes of confidence, some help, some recommendations on programs. And you guys are far more connected than we are in the world of opportunity. We focus on our customers, so I really need advice and help and opportunity, and we'll pave the way if you help give us the tools. So that's the update from Breedlove Guitar Company.
Thank you, Peter. Are you at liberty to explain to the committee some of the top names that are buying these guitars that are made from Oregon products and resources?
You bet. It's a fun list, and we review this every so often. But we've built 8 guitars from Madonna and Guy Ritchie. There's some superstars on tour right now. Sugarland has several of our guitars on tour. The guys from Wilco. There's Justin Moore is number one in the CMA charts right now with the Breedlove. And really, the list goes on and on and on. And the guitars, they last, you know, 100 years. So a lot of our guitars end up on albums throughout LA, Nashville, and New York, and now into Germany and France and the UK. And these are big, big areas. And so this little tiny company in the jewel of Oregon is just now making those waves after being at it for 20 years. So does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you, Peter. Before we move on to the next three, so to speak, are there any questions from anybody on the committee for anybody that's already testified? Okay, then let's see. I think we're moving to Craig, and then actually, Roger, I don't know how you've got everybody seated around the table.
I'm going to move so other people can sit up here.
Okay.
Whoever you call out can take my seat. So.
Let's see. Craig, Tim, I saw Tim come in recently. Marshall Crew, you guys are at the other end. Well, anybody testifying needs to move to the other end of the table where Roger was. Musical chairs. Okay. Tim, you want to start?
You bet. Good afternoon. I'm Tim Casey, Executive Director for the Bend Chamber of Commerce, and I'd like to thank you for letting us come in and talk with you this afternoon. Hopefully this isn't the last time. I know it's the first time for me. The question that was posed to me was, what can the state of Oregon do better to support businesses in this current economic environment? And what I did was I took it to the membership. I asked, I sent the question out and I got some responses. And what I'd like to do is go ahead and share the responses with you and you can decide what you think. The first one is to help contractors. Currently, the state and federal government contract for opportunities generated by the federal stimulus money seem to only be awarded to contractors who have already done business with the government. It seems extremely difficult for small construction and contracting companies to bid for government contracts because of the bonding requirements. The next one is to repeal the tax increases from the last session. As we're doing with ballot measures 66 and 67, those types of measures will simply kill small businesses like ours. We will sell products every year and always have sales, but that doesn't mean that our company will profit in times like these. We need to support destination resorts. They're an important industry in Central Oregon. They create and maintain family wage jobs, and we need that right now. Energy credits should be curtailed. The Senate had it right last year, and the governor's veto was wrong. We'd like to see you send it through again. PERS is going to sink us unless we change it. the program is draining state resources and will have to be replenished by taxes on businesses. And then there were suggestions at the legislative level to put taxes on sugar-added beverages to help pay for health care reform. The beverage industry owners sent letters to you about this issue, and it will have a significant negative impact on the entire beverage industry. And I hope that you continue to take efforts to stop that. Oregon is ranked number one in the U.S. for total taxes, in the top three highest per state minimum wage, the top three in unemployment. And we need to create incentives for all businesses, large and small, to stay in Oregon and to increase employment. Significant reductions in these three areas mentioned will go a long ways towards accomplishing this. Prevailing wage is doing more harm than good for businesses. Though I understand some changes are underway for calculations, prevailing wage takes small businesses out of the game. Because of the calculation, employers are unable to hire more employees, thus stifling job creation in these tough economic times. In general, there's too much new regulation along with too many new rules, procedures, required forms, submittals, reports, etc. It's hard to stay in business without additional burdens from the government. Generally, the result is government hiring additional people to handle the new paperwork, and small businesses are struggling to try to stay in compliance and stay on top of the new regulations. And then the final comment I have here is, we cannot tax ourselves to prosperity. Businesses are the engine that will pull us out of this mess. Until the state recognizes this, unemployment will continue to spiral out of control. I received several phone calls on Tuesday, and that's when folks received the unemployment tax rate notice. People were pretty upset because there was a significant increase in the tax rates for unemployment. One of the members put it to me this way. They said, you know, had I known that the increases were going to be so high, I would have laid off an additional person to be able to afford it. And I think that's a problem for us. When we extend and increase benefits while lowering the standards for qualification, what we do is we create a situation where more taxes are needed. And it becomes a vicious cycle where businesses have to pay more in taxes, and in this economy are not increasing in their sales. So in order to pay for it, they're not seeing an increase in the sales, but they're having to cut back. In order to cut back, they have to reduce employees, which puts another person back in the system, which the state then has to pay unemployment to, and in order to afford that, they have to go back to businesses and tax more. And it's a vicious cycle that we're getting into. In a nutshell, businesses are struggling with the burden of increased taxes. Another member put it to me this way. He said, with all the taxes, charges, and fees, he feels like he's being marched towards death by 1,000 cuts. Those are poetic. We need to stop the momentum of taxes and take a fundamental approach. At every opportunity, we need to look for ways to reduce the burden of government on the backs of businesses. A strong, healthy business creates jobs, and jobs create revenue back to the state.
Thank you, Tim. Let's see, who do we have next? Craig?
Yes. Hi, I'm Craig August with Advanced Machine Services, and I guess we don't have a very large company. We're an actual typical company here in Bend. We employ about 10, and we produce or manufacture parts for half the people in this room. And just recently, we've been involved with OMEP, and we've been going through Lean, and it's been a real good situation for us. And we envision at the end of this year, because of Lean, we'll add 15% to 18% onto our bottom line. So that's been a real good experience for us. As for me, I've been in Bend since 80. I've been involved in manufacturing, so I've seen wood products to high tech to pharmaceutical, and just recently the entering and the exiting of the airplane industry. So we've survived that just by relationships with our customers and people that want to get things built in Oregon. And I'm here today. One of the other things that went on, and there's been some things fixed, but we recently built a building in Bend, and when things were on the up, and I have never talked to a business in Bend that's built a building here that has had a good experience. So I don't know if that can be addressed here today, but these brand new companies that are coming in here and building, they need to know that somebody has their back and that they want them to succeed. So that's basically all that I have to say today. So
thank you. Let's see. Any questions of this?
Yeah. This is Floyd Przonski. And Tim, when you were giving your testimony, I didn't catch the name of your business, and I was wondering if you could tell me how it's actually structured. What type of structure of corporation is it?
Sure. I'm the executive director of the Bend Chamber of Commerce. So we're a nonprofit business organization.
Yeah, I heard that, but in your testimony, you talked about maybe you're giving an example of somebody that was talking about their business being impacted by the taxes that are proposed under Measure 67. Do you know whether or not they are a C corporation?
I do not.
All right. Do you know that under the Measure 67, those who are LLC, LLPs, or S corporations will not they'll have an increase from the minimum tax of $10, but only to $150. There will be no other tax obligations.
I do.
All right.
And I think at the very end of it, when I was relaying the statement from one of our members, was that he was talking about the death by 1,000 cuts,
right.
And every increase has an impact.
Right.
And it's by itself, it's not significant, but when you start adding up all of the fees and taxes, it really becomes a burden.
Yeah, I don't think we want to. We're going to have plenty of time to have the marketing and the education of this. There's obviously education on all sides, so I don't want to get this into a political bantering or battle.
At this point, all I'm trying to do is get information. I just want to make certain the information that is being discussed in a hearing today is actually based on facts. And I guess, Tim, the other part that you brought up was your belief or your understanding as to how businesses are taxed in this state and what the overall tax burden is. You gave some numbers as to being number one on some different areas. Could you please provide to the committee staff the I guess whatever authority you're relying on, because what I've received from the legislative offices is that the overall tax burden for businesses in Oregon ranks somewhere between 46th and 49th. And so overall, that seems to me that we're being very conducive for businesses in this state. And if I'm getting wrong information, I need to know that. And so whatever information you've relied on in your testimony today to support that we are at the top tier of not being, quote-unquote, business-friendly because of the taxes and fees, I'd like to have that information so I can take that to our legislative revenue office and have them explain why they're giving us different information.
And I'd be happy to do that after the meeting. I plan on sending the information that I was reading came from the membership, so there are notes and testimonies from our members, and I'd be happy to gather more information and get that over to you so you can take a look at it.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. That's all I'm asking. I'm not expecting you to, let's say, give me that information now, but whatever you have relied on, I'd like to have that so I can compare it with what I've already heard, because it's somewhere we're getting misinformation. Either you're getting it or I'm getting it, and I'm going to go to the nonpartisan wing of the legislature and ask them to tell us what is right.
Yeah, because I've heard different numbers, too, from 2 to 10 just today. So,
right.
You know, it's all over the board. So we'll obviously get there. Senator Rosenbaum, you had a question?
Yes, thanks a lot, Madam Chair. And I'm really struck by actually not just this panel, but when we heard from Altrek and Breedlove Guitars. It sounds like actually some pretty successful businesses out in Bend despite these challenges. And I know also, Craig, just you're talking about your employees. It sounds like you've been able to hold on to the employees that you have. But I'm just wondering, maybe not a question for you, but anybody else that talks, nobody has mentioned two things that I hear about a lot, and one is healthcare, which I know, you know, everywhere in the state, the price of healthcare has been skyrocketing, and people are being dropped, you know, we're having not able to keep up the cost of providing healthcare for their employees. And then the other one is just the issue of credit and being able to get financing when you need it, get a line of credit when you need it from a lending institution. And I don't know if that's an issue for your particular business or maybe the chamber has some experience of that. But are either of those issues affecting the scene for small businesses over there?
Well, I can kind of speak to that a little bit.
Tell us who's talking. So
yeah, let's see. Who's talking?
Excuse me, this is Craig Ockitz with Advanced Machining Services.
Unfortunately, we can't see you, Craig, so.
Okay.
Oh, I'm okay. Okay.
Your hand's in front of your...
Sorry.
Yeah, there you go.
I think I'm like everybody in this room. I think we provide health insurance for our employees and our families, and every year it's a big decision whether to raise the deductible or cut out somebody, or you know. So we've been able to keep up with that. And as far as the bank goes, as far as financing, we've been really fortunate. Of course, the bank only gives you an umbrella when the sun's out, you know, and that's always been the case, you know. But so I really haven't had a problem with that. So
if I could comment on both, we've seen healthcare. This is Mike Morford with Altrek.com. Sorry. We today employ about 150 individuals, and we have seen our healthcare costs rise on average on an annual basis of about 20% for the last probably at least 6 or 7 years. It is our largest expense in the business, and we try and provide a premium level of healthcare for our staff. Because we're in the outdoor industry, we tend to have a lot of young and healthy individuals, and yet this is an expense that is weighing us down quite significantly. So that would be my comment on the healthcare. And on the banking, we almost went out of business earlier this year because of the banking issues. We worked with probably the largest bank in the United States. And after the 2008 fourth quarter holiday season and with the economic collapse, the bank became very jumpy, and we cleaned out our line of credit. And when we came to a point of wanting to renew it, they terminated the line of credit with 24 hours notice. It was a substantial line of credit, and we spent the next 3 months working with a new bank, a stronger bank, establishing a new line of credit. But the process did a significant amount of damage financially to our business in 2008 or 2009, and we are still in the recovery stages from the quick action of a bank that frankly, 2 months after they terminated the line, came back and apologized to us and said that they probably should not have done it, but at that point it was too late. In which, you know, we turned around and we established a new line with a new bank, actually wound up increasing our line of credit from the old line of credit. We went I don't know how to say it without saying exact numbers, but we went from a line of credit that was in excess of $3 million to a line of credit that was more than almost 100% larger with the new bank. But we are still very concerned about our commercial real estate and the devaluing of the real estate, as part of our line of credit was based off of the equity in that building. And that's of great concern to us as we go into the future, because our ability to use that equity will likely be cut off, or it will be reduced dramatically because the building is devaluing because of the overall marketplace. And yet our business is growing. Just to give one example, last month, the month of October, we grew in excess of 60% annualized growth. And we need financing to finance that growth. And if our bank devalues the building, which they're in the process of doing, we don't know how we're going to get that financing, and we will have to retract that growth and slow it down and slow the job growth as a result. So,
thank you.
I've got some comments too, if you'd like.
So, Peter.
Our situation is slightly different in that we have operations in Asia as well as Central Oregon. And so I don't believe that I have any control over healthcare or the banking industry. And so the kinds of decisions that I make are, do we build it in Asia or do we build it here? And we're always trying to maximize what we build here, but each year it does get more challenging. And so the solutions that I have are, we continue to stratify or diversify our manufacturing practices. And the other choice is, can we create a system that doesn't include a bank? And so, you know, I'm in the process of trying to raise $100 million, which would eliminate the need for a lending institution. And so it's really, what are we doing to help the banks? And our customers, you know, that relied on the home equity line of credits and lines for their businesses, their ability to purchase is limited. And that's not just an Oregon problem, but those are really real issues, but I don't feel like it's worth bitching about because I have no control over it. Maybe you do. Maybe you have solutions
that's
there.
The feds.
But the biggest part of that is, do we make it in Oregon or do we make it around the world? So that's where you guys can help make that decision.
Thank anybody else on those topics of healthcare, banking?
Peter, this is Floyd Przanski. Peter, I think one of the things that you bring up is a lot of frustration for us at the state because we are not in the position to regulate the most of the banks because they're federally chartered, and also on the healthcare. So I would encourage everyone over there in the business community to be reaching out to your U.S. congressman, which I assume is Greg Walden, as well as your two U.S. senators, as to making certain that they hear the concerns of what decisions are being made in D.C., because they impact us here as much as they do in Bend.
I have Marshall still on my list. Is Earl Bowerman there?
Yes.
Oh, there's Earl.
Yes.
Okay. How about Marshall and Earl and Bill Scannell?
Present.
Which place is Earl,
do you
want to
sit down?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll let you guys go and identify yourselves and go in whatever order you want to go.
I'll go ahead. Madam Chair, thank you for the time today. My name is Bill Scannell. I'm the president of Structis Building Technologies. We manufacture and sell proprietary construction products related to drywall. We've been recognized as a leader in our field because of the products. And since most of the products are one of a kind, we have the luxury of being able to manufacture here in Bend, Oregon, and not somewhere in the center of the country with the balance of our competitors. We appreciate that every day, and we hope to be able to continue to do so, but this depends on the economic health of the state to a large extent. We currently employ 58 people, full-time positions here in a variety of disciplines. 47 of them are here at our facility in Bend. The balance of them are in sales positions throughout the country. And we ship full truckloads of products from our docks here in Bend to distributors around the world. We've recently signed an agreement with one of the biggest building companies in the world, and we're looking forward to fulfilling that obligation. There's two programs I'd like to talk about that highlight today that are state-funded and hopefully will continue to be so, and they've really changed the course of our business and helped to allow us to remain competitive. First off, the WorkShare program. No secret that our industry, new construction, has been battered over the last couple of years. And most of our forward indicators are not generating boundless optimism in the near future. We're going to continue to be challenged by being able to gainfully employ our talented team. Our sales volumes dropped by more than 40%. Our lease, utilities, fuel costs, and raw materials have steadily increased. yet we haven't been able to gain any price improvements during the cycle to mitigate the rising costs. After a voluntary workforce reduction last fall, we've still been forced to reduce benefits, pay rates, work hours, and a number of other considerations for our remaining employees. Our ability to supplement their pay and keep them relatively whole during this, the WorkShare programs provided us a tremendous alternative to cutting these team members entirely. When our industry recovers, as we are confident that it will, we're going to participate in the recovery with the engaged, qualified group of people that we've been able to keep. Secondly, we want to talk about the OMEP program, Oregon Manufacturing Extension Program. In 2005, we had a great business, but we knew there was room for improvement. And so OMEP, at that time, to my knowledge, was new to the area. And we enlisted the help of an OMEP employee at the time to evaluate our processes. This gentleman, who's fairly new to Central Oregon at the time, ended up coming to work for us and has been pivotal in developing our training and production team, moving us forward towards world-class standards. He's worked hard to raise the overall caliber of manufacturing environment here in Central Oregon and is a powerful advocate for manufacturers throughout the region. Because of his expertise, many of our team members now have developed lean manufacturing competencies, and other skills have allowed them to go into the community as volunteers to assist other manufacturers in their development. We recently had a former human resources manager from Toyota Corporation, who is now a nationally recognized author and an expert on lean manufacturing, return to Bend for the third time and tell a group of us that across the country, he uses the success story of Central Oregon's manufacturing community as testimony to what's possible when a community works together to share its learning. Those who have fought for this and continue to fight for the funding of these programs should take great pride in this. Without these state-funded programs, we would likely have had to relocate to the central or even eastern U.S. to remain competitive. As a startup with patent protection, we chose Bend for its lifestyle, and we might not always enjoy the patent protection, but we have stayed and will continue to stay because of the people that we have here, but only if the state continues to care about maintaining companies like ours. I'm asking for your consideration on behalf of all the manufacturers who can and will benefit from the continuation of these and other state programs. We can create a diverse economic base here, but we need your help because it is a fragile condition. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you, Bill. Can I interrupt? Could you explain a little about OMEP? There's some on the committee that aren't familiar with it. The Oregon Manufacturers Expansion Program, I think, is what it is.
Extension Program. Yeah, I'd like to be able to give you a real solid background of what they actually do. Our experience of them was that they are linked to us through EDCO, and they come into the community as basically a private entity, but to, again, raise the caliber and the standard of manufacturing practices. So these are engineers typically that have lean disciplines, manufacturing disciplines. And, you know, Central Oregon is kind of an island. So a lot of big cities around the country have been at these practices for a number of years, but a lot of the companies that are here locally are relatively uninitiated in terms of lean manufacturing. And so OMEP has done a great deal over the last couple of years to elevate the entire manufacturing industry here. You know, not only do I benefit from it, my wife works for a company who has recently engaged the help of OMEP, and it's changed their business. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's good. It's not a state-supported. It's separate from the state. It's not a state agency.
Senator Telfer, it's Roger Lee. I'm not in the picture, but you can hear me at least. That's probably enough. OMEP is supported by both the state and federal funds that are matched with each other, and that funding passes through the Oregon Economic Development Department, which is now Business Oregon.
Right. Okay, great.
And the other thing, Bill, regarding the WorkShare, is that a program that helps offset the cost of the salaries of individuals in lean times?
Yeah, absolutely. It has lifted a burden for us. We, again, last fall, we came into the real difficult part of the cycle of the new construction environment. And we offered a voluntary layoff for at that time, 20 of our people, and they took it. And we thought that that was going to mitigate that challenge for us. It turned even worse in the coming months, and we turned the Workshare program. That's afforded us the opportunity to have our team basically engaged full-time in terms of their pay and benefits. So it's really carried us. I can't overstate the fact, that it has carried us through this cycle. And, if I hadn't advocated passionately enough, we would really like to see that continue.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Earl Bowerman. I'm a Bend resident for the last 10 years. I just retired from Intel after 26 years living over in Portland and Hillsboro. And I basically retired to do a startup company here in Bend, Oregon. We started a new company. It's an alternative energy. It's a company called PV Tracker. Not to be confused with PV Power that's here in Bend. However, the founder of PV Power is also the founder of PV Tracker. And what we're seeing, I'm going to talk a little bit about our frustration as a startup, where we could use some help. We have gone through the whole Betsy program, and what we found is that program, with its intent to help startups, is very fragmented and very difficult to implement and compete. And what I mean by that is, in the state of Oregon this last year, we had several large companies that were foreign-owned start up new companies in Oregon as new startups, and was getting millions. I want to say, of the 10 that I saw, they averaged about $10 million of the Betsy funding. So it left the little startup companies here in Bend and other places around Oregon really scrapping for a few dollars. And those dollars are crucial to a startup. Just to give you an idea of the size of the potential of our company, we've doubled every 2 months in Bend. We announced our product at the LA show, World Show in LA, about 3 weeks ago. We're getting over 200 hits a day on our website across 40 different countries. We're quoting multi-million dollar installs for commercial and utility grade energy. And most of the interest basically is coming from Spain, Germany, and India. But we want to try to grow this company in Oregon. Right now, I have 16 suppliers in Oregon, as we have doubled every 2 months, so of those 16 different industries. And there's empty factories all over Oregon. They're running about 20-25% capacity of what they were running 3-4 years ago. And everyone that I'm working with in Oregon is jumping through hoops to help us be successful. One of the things that's causing us a lot of problem is the credit industry. Because we're a new startup, we're having to spend a lot more on initial purchase orders to suppliers. Everybody's a little punchy out there. So I see an opportunity in Betsy, keeping the program strong, but give new businesses that are starting up maybe a 2-year waiver on the application fee. The application fee for that program is about $6,000, and that's fairly significant for a startup company. So I'm a certified lean auditor. I grew the worldwide supply chain at Intel for 10 years. I've implemented lean at 60 companies in 20 countries. And I agree with the opportunities that we have here in Oregon for lean. And most of the states that I've worked in the United States, the states subsidize heavily that lean training for new startup companies and corporations in their state. And I think if Oregon were to get aggressive with that, that would be very beneficial to Central Oregon as well. Any questions?
Earl, this is Floyd Przonski. I want to agree with you on the Betsy. We looked at that in this last full session with the Environment and Natural Resources, and there are some of us that were questioning why the larger, more established companies were going to be getting what I call the lion's share instead of really focusing on the startups. I will make certain your comments get to the chair of that committee, because hopefully we'll be looking at this again in the February mini session.
Yes, thank you, Senator.
Anybody else? Marshall?
Yes, my name is Marshall Crew, and I'm the president of Gear Pharmaceuticals, which is probably a little bit different than the other companies here in the sense that we're part of the biotech community that is, I'd say, just beginning to grow here in Central Oregon. And we're also very excited about that because we think that it has a tremendous potential here in Central Oregon to create much above average salary jobs. So we think that we have the potential to have a significant impact on the economy in Central Oregon. But there are a number of different hurdles that stand in our way, not the least of which is incentives for bringing other biotech companies to Central Oregon. And we see this as being very critical because there isn't a critical mass of skilled workforce here in Central Oregon. And that's something that is a very large impediment to other companies locating here in Central Oregon. And we think that that's something that definitely needs to be addressed. And it's a real problem because you have this chicken and egg issue where normally biotech communities are started around university systems. And Central Oregon, of course, as you know, has a very small footprint in terms of university. And for sure, there are no research institutions locally. And that is the typical route for industries like biotech to be founded and grow is on typically from university professors who have ideas and they can spin these things out into companies. The other major issue for us here in Central Oregon is venture funding. Typically, if you talk to anyone who is in the venture capital community, Oregon is largely bypassed for California and our neighbors to the north in Washington State. And Oregon is in general has a pretty bad reputation of following through and returning the investment from venture capital. And that's something that we definitely need to change. And the reason for that is that biotech companies in general are very capital intensive. And that venture funding is mandatory at some stage in a pharmaceutical company like ourselves. Our business is really aiming at doing drug discovery and development, which I believe is very complementary to the signature research centers that are mainly in the Valley. These are organizations that have been largely pushed forward by the Oregon Innovation Council. And we've been talking to folks, say, at Otrati, and the big missing part of drug development in Oregon is the chemistry as well as the drug development side. So Otrati fills a nice niche where they really handle a lot of the biology, and the universities handle a lot of the sort of very, very early chemistries, but there is no company in Oregon that is really devoted to significantly impacting the drug discovery and development side of this, and that's the niche that we want to fill, and where you guys could probably play a major role is in helping us fill that niche and really build as a state the entire drug discovery and development infrastructure. And I think, Washington State is a great example of how that can be done. The difference, of course, is what I said earlier, is that that's all been really founded around University of Washington and the big centers like the Fred Hutch. So we have to do it, I think, a lot more grassroots and probably be a lot more, committed to it. But I think it's something that it really fits well with the quality of life here. The thing that you have to keep in mind is that quality of life is not sufficient to attract and retain businesses like biotech. It has to be a lot more than that. And so we definitely need to provide those incentives. And there are a number of different ideas about how to do that. But I think working with, say, the Oregon Innovation Council, maybe there's a way that between industry partners, say developers, the state and then companies that are committed to growing biotech here in Oregon, we can put a consortium together that, that really bolsters, say, this infrastructure problem. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marshall. Let's see, is Bill Moseley come in the room? And I think the only other name I have here is Brian Nicholson.
That's me. Brian is here. Bill is not.
Okay. Is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify besides Brian? Okay, Brian. Take us home then.
All right, I'll try to go quickly. How's that? First of all, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it. We know you have busy schedules. My name is Brian Nicholson, and I'm the owner of Michi Designs here in Bend. We manufacture lighting and occasional tables, primarily for the hospitality and healthcare markets. So next time you're in a Marriott, maybe it might be a Michi lamp on your nightstand. Actually, in fact, we're shipping the Heathman Hotel room lighting next month. So next time you go to Heathman and stay there, they may be Michi lights. Working in the hospitality industry, it has been unbelievably difficult in economy for really the last 15 months. Sitting over on the side of the table and hearing the stories of the other gentlemen here at the table, I'm encouraged that everybody doesn't have it as quite as bad as we do. But it's been very, very difficult. Our business is down approximately 60% by the end of the year versus a year ago. So it's been real tough. And my comments are going to echo a lot of what has already been said. First and foremost is our relationship with OMEP and the lean training that we've gotten. We've been working with OMEP for just over a year, and we were also the beneficiaries of a workforce training grant, which quite frankly made our OMEP training possible. We would not have been able to do it had we had to fund that all out of our own pocket. So please don't do anything to diminish our ability to access those grant monies. I don't think it's an overstatement for me to say, had it not been for OMEP's participation in our company, we're a small company, limited expertise in certain areas, and you need to bring in outside consultants to help you facilitate certain things. Without their involvement, I don't think I'd be here as a business owner today. I don't think our business would be here anymore. And this is a business that's been in Central Oregon since 1998, been around for 20-plus years. So I cannot overstate the value of that lean training and the participation of OMEP. I will also say there's a requirement for our access of small business to expertise that they don't necessarily have in house, and organizations like OMEP can really provide that expertise for a small company that doesn't necessarily have it, and their engineers who know what they're doing. So it can really move things forward. The other specific thing that I wanted to mention is Workshare. And unfortunately, we had to partake of Workshare. It's been critically important for us, again, to retain quality employees. Surprisingly enough, our employees, our morale is very good at our company, even though we've suffered immensely. And one of the reasons for that is because things like Workshare are available to us. We can say, listen, we can all share the pain here a little bit and lose some hours for each of us, but we're all going to be mostly whole, and we don't have to let somebody go. In a small company, we have 11 employees. They're family. And when you don't have to let somebody go and you have an alternative like Workshare, it's critical, and I cannot say enough about that. So that's, in a nutshell, I think that's what I really wanted to get across today. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Any questions of any of the testimony, particularly the last three?
I just wanted, because Workshare has come up a couple of times, and that is really something that we can take some credit for, because this committee and the legislature in our last session did continue on the Workshare program, which uses unemployment insurance trust funds to enable people to stay employed and collect some benefit from the UI fund. So I think although we sometimes feel like we aren't reaching out or providing the help that we would like to, that is one program where we were able to do something in 2009. And then I just wanted to ask both Marshall and Brian, both of you have mentioned the workforce training issues, and our committee is called Commerce and Workforce Development. So did you have anything more you wanted to say about, I know, Marshall, you mentioned the challenges of recruiting or retaining a skilled workforce. Some of those sound like they're issues just about where other academic institutions and other parts of the puzzle are located, but is there more that you can think of that some of these state programs could be doing to help?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but what I see as being a missing piece to the puzzle is advanced degrees in Central Oregon, 4-year degrees specifically. Our industry is not a trade industry. What we really rely on are very highly trained people. Bachelor's degree in chemistry or physics or degrees like that, biology, are mandatory to even walk in the door. To apply for a job, you must have at least a bachelor's degree in one of those fields. And preferably more advanced degrees, and so all of those types of workers are trained in the valley, so the major universities. And what we'd like to see is a stronger emphasis, for example, at OSU Cascades, to bring in more of those science type degrees to help grow this industry. I think it's very, very critical that we do that. And so it's not so much a workforce training as it is really a part of the university system. And I know that there's been a lot of discussion about OSU Cascades' future, and I'm here to tell you, if it goes away, it's a devastating blow to the Central Oregon.
Thanks.
Thank you, Marshall. Anything else? Senator Monroe.
Well, I appreciated that last comment. When I introduced myself, I chaired the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and once there were people that suggested to us that we might want to close that institution, and I resisted that very strongly. I believe that we have to do a better job of making higher ed available, especially to people east of the mountains and in Central Oregon. And so I appreciated your comment, reinforced the position that I took last session.
Thank you for your support.
Well, with that, I'm going to thank you all for taking time out of your days to give us some information and some input that will fill our day. So with that, I don't know who pulls the plug on everybody, but...
Before we do that, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, my staff just brought in what I've received from our Legislative Revenue Office. And, Tim, if you want to just have this information, what they are providing, you can get online. It's called the Total State and Local Business Taxes, and it ranks all 50 states. And it's published on January 2009, and it has Ernst & Young and then Cost as the, I guess, the two bodies that actually did the study. So that's what I would like.
Is it online?
It is online, and I'll make sure Senator Toeffler's staff knows what the site is so you can access it. It's pretty lengthy. It's about 40-something pages in length.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You bet. Thank you for the information you're going to be sending to us.
Thank you again for your time.
And I wanted to just thank Senator Toeffler and her staff for putting together this panel, because this really was a first for us. And thank you to everybody that came in today. I know how busy you are, so keep up the great work.
Do you have time for another question?
Sure.
Pardon me. Are there particular programs that you're looking at cutting or putting more funding in that you'd like some input on?
Oh, that's a big one.
Well, input would be helpful. We're not at this point. This committee is not looking at cutting or funding anything at this point right now. And
The Ways and Means Committee is the committee that actually, you know, say divvies out where money's going to go or where it may be taken from. And I think Senator Monroe would probably be a better person to kind of share where they may be going. But at this point, I think what we're looking for is how do we maintain Oregon in its entirety? And clearly what you brought to the table today and giving us insight to at least two state programs or affiliated state programs that have been very important, we'd like to make certain we keep those going.
Disconnected you, I guess.
Okay.
Well, oh dear. Was that on a timer?
I don't know, but I cannot get them back.
Well, it probably wasn't us.
That's okay. Madam Chair, I can do follow up as well and provide contact information, and also for I think there were some questions in the exchange of information back and forth. I can facilitate that and distribute that to the members.
Okay.
I'll take care of that.
That's what they were seeing anyway. That looks like that's us.
Were we in the dark?
Just confirmed their feelings, I'm sure.
Well, I'll give you back the gavel. So,
Well, no, great. Just gavel us out.
Anything else?
Great.
Well, we're adjourned.